Welcome to Normal Adjustments, because not all tales are created equal, and neither the people that tell them. Welcome everyone to Normal Adjustments. Here is Nicole, your host, to introduce another season of the podcast. Welcome to season three. And to kick off the season, I have with me a very special person and a friend at distance because we don't know each other, Olivia Eggers. Hi, Olivia.
Hi, how's it going, Nicole?
I'm good. Thank you for being here. I'm very excited about this and I'm flattered that you said yes.
Yes, I'm so excited too. Just to provide a little background on myself, my name is Olivia. I'm 24 and I live in Boston. I'm from California though, and I am a legal assistant, but also a primary lymphy. And I'm just excited to get to chat with you today about our topic. It's going to be great.
Yeah. Thank you for being here. So just before we start kind of like the topic in hand, which, you know, it's very dear to both of our hearts. I just wanted to introduce anyone to this space I have never been. I want to introduce myself as well. My name is Nicole Facio. I am a fellow lymphy. What that means is that I am a lymphedema patient, primary lymphedema patient since birth. And I created this space, this podcast a year and a half ago in the middle of the pandemic, but it's not a pandemic podcast. Neither is a lymphedema podcast. It's a podcast about bringing stories of humans being humans, because I believe that normal is a construct and a concept that doesn't really exist. And that all these stories, what really brings to life is the reality that we all have our way, our own normal, and that's totally fine. And it basically normalizes imperfection, because imperfection is what makes the world, I guess, a better place and diverse and beautiful. So with that said, it's inspired on my story, a lymphedema story since I was born. And because of that, it's inspired in the topic at hand today, which is disabilities. It's a topic that it's been very hard for myself to talk about, not because it's taboo or like it's difficult, just because it was difficult for myself to accept I had a disability. And that is why I want to dissect why Nicole had such a hard time. And it's not because Nicole had a hard time, it's because it is a difficult topic to talk about for many people and to accept and to come to terms with. And that's why we have Olivia here today to talk about it.
Yes, I'm so excited because, I mean, like you, I also have primary lymphedema since birth and also went through, you know, that same path of not wanting to accept disability, feeling very strange about it, the isolation. So I'm excited to talk about that today and all of the different parts of it, disability, because I know there's controversy, there are a lot of definitions, so we can get into all of that.
Perfect. I love it. And look, before we start, I want to just quickly describe what lymphedema is for, and the benefit of the ones that I don't know, because I talk about it a lot, but I have found that it is, well, not a found, I know, but I keep finding that it's not known in many areas, not only in the public, but also in the medical community. So on the benefit of people, I want to describe, like, lymphedema is a chronic condition, which we'll get into that as well, because we describe lymphedema as a condition, and I am right now, I'm not sure if that's the correct way we should be describing it, but that's the way it's in the medical journals. It's a chronic condition that causes chronic swelling due to a disrupted lymphatic system that can be traumatized because of an operation, which is what's known as secondary lymphedema, or because at birth you had malformations of the system. The lymphatic system is one of the most important systems in our bodies, but it's a secondary system to most of our processes. That's why a lot of people don't know about it as a primary system, but it is there as a primary system. And it takes our fluids out of our bodies. Therefore, if the system is malformed, our fluids are accumulated. And that's what happens to us. There's no cure for lymphedema. And that's, I don't say that in a tragic way. I say that with a reality. But that's okay because it is totally treatable. And that's why we're here today, because we've both been treated. We both have correct courses of action. And that's why we're here, to be able to talk about it. And we are able to live our lives healthy with lymphedema. But that's not the case there in the world. There are so many people that have their mobility, their lives detrimented and very affected because there is such a lack of knowledge about the condition. And therefore, there's a lack of knowledge in the disabled world as well of lymphedema. And it might be because of this problem that we're calling it a condition, but we can get to that later. And look, when I started talking about my journey, I started talking about my journey in a kind of like a positive connotation. For why? Because there is a lot of negativity around a lot of stuff, and specifically lymphedema, because we suffer. It's not because it shouldn't be shut down, and I'm not trying to shut that down, but I wanted to bring another flavor of it. I wanted to say, yes, I have this, but this is how you can live with it, and don't be ashamed. Don't hide yourself. You can be healthy. You can be active, etc. And in that journey, I kind of like lived, and I keep living that positivity as a, I guess as a main thing in my life. But then I heard your story, Olivia, and like you talked about it very beautifully, how your troubles that you had growing up, the troubles that you had particularly, and how difficult it was sometimes to go to even doctors, and how you felt like a specimen. And I'll let you tell that story, but it really transported me to the moments I felt exactly the same. And it really inspired me on talking about this, because I never want to sound like I'm dismissing the truth behind it all. That's not what it is at all. I think about things of transcending that point. But I went through exactly the same things, and I just dealt with it a bit differently. Not necessarily that's correct or wrong or anything. It's just I decided to maybe ignore that or just say, like, you're bothering me and my brain. I don't want to pay attention to you. But you really humanized it, and I really transported me to those moments. And I have to, one, thank you for it. And yeah, just give you the floor to tell your story.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And thank you. I mean, Nicole, it has been so beneficial and cathartic for me to, one, like, become a part of this lymphy community after 24 years of living with it, but to also see your podcast and to get to hear your episode. Like, I think you are doing such a service to so many people, allowing us to, you know, embrace these parts of ourselves that maybe for a very long time we didn't feel comfortable to do. So yeah, let's get into it. I'm very excited. So yeah, I was also, like Nicole, born with primary lymphedema. I have it globally. It was due to a malformation of my lymphatic system in utero. Like, I have very narrow lymph channels, they believe. And then I have a lack of lymph nodes. So it doesn't allow for transportation of that fluid. So I have the swelling that accumulates mostly in my extremities, but throughout my body and my face, so on and so forth. So while I was born with it, I did not end up getting diagnosed with lymphedema until I was around 9 months old. And that was quite a process for my parents, because they noticed when I, you know, exited the womb that things did not look quote unquote normal. I had a lot of swelling in my head, and my parents noticed the swelling started to move down to my feet. And they asked doctors, like, what's going on here? And doctors were like, this is a fat baby. Like, congratulations. She's well fed.
Olivia, do you know that I also got diagnosed at 9 months?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's awesome. So exciting.
That should mean something. Yeah,
it should. That's a big moment for us 9 months in. But yeah, so they really, medical professionals stuck with the idea that I was a chunky baby. And then at 9 months old, there was a doctor, Dr. Whitty, who was a lymphedema specialist. And he was like, no, your child actually has primary lymphedema. And there we went.
Was this in the States? Was this in the States?
It was in the States. Yeah. I was on the West Coast, I think, at this time. I think Dr. Whitty was maybe in New Orleans. I'm not sure exactly. Okay. But yeah, we had explored a lot of different options, just trying to find anyone who had any knowledge of, you know, this disease. And it was difficult. So starting at 9 months old, that process really became of trying to find treatment. What can we do? Because, you know, you're given that diagnosis of this is not curable. So basically, she's going to have to learn how to live with it and manage her disease. And it became a journey, as yeah. you know, as you also I know. Experienced. Yeah. So from a young age, I too was, you know, being bandaged and going through manual lymph drainage. I went through like laser therapy in my hands. I don't even fully understand all of that.
Why did they do that?
So one of the weird things with my lymphedema, and I still don't have an answer on it. I've like asked everyone and no one knows, is my hands and my feet are bright red and have been bright red since the moment I was born. Like you can look at baby photos of me and my hands are tomato red. Just fire red. And so what they ended up doing was some doctor had recommended doing laser therapy on the hands to see if that would decrease the color and the swelling. And it did end up working in my right hand. Like it really went down and so did the coloring. And we did it a few times, not a lot of benefit otherwise.
I've never heard about it though. It's interesting. Yeah.
It's so weird. And it also randomly has to do with the weather too. Like if I start to get cold, my hands go from red to purple. So it's like, and that happens with my feet too. I think it's like a circulation yeah. thing, but yeah. also I'd been told, you know, at the clinic that it might be because of like vein issues and vessel
yeah,
issues.
I was going
like,
to say, yeah.
Yeah. So it's really weird. We don't fully understand, but yeah, there was a lot of medical treatment from an early age and a lot to look at and just a lot of unanswered questions that we had to figure out. And so I think for me, you know, I'm the oldest of four. I'm the only one in my family who has a disability in some capacity. Like with lymphedema, it can often be hereditary. That was not the mm-hmm. case for mine. So doctors were like, we do not know why you have this condition. And from the beginning, I think from being a toddler, I knew that there was something off, I guess, with me, mm-hmm. That I did not look like others. And I really started to notice this when I went to elementary school. And a moment mm-hmm. that really sticks out for me is I am fully wrapped up, you know, on the playground. My legs are all bandaged because I'm going through compression therapy, so on and so forth. And I would stay bandaged for multiple days, go to my appointment. They'd unwrap me. We'd do measurements. They'd wrap me back up. They'd send me back to school. And so I would stand on the playground in all of my bandages and like notice the other kids around me kind of avoiding me, not coming near me. They were really confused. And I was also very confused because, you know, you don't understand all of the complexities of your disorder that you have. So all I knew is that I had to, you know, go through all of this treatment while others did not. And that in itself made me feel very ashamed of the way I was. And it's interesting because you talked about, you know, how you only a few years ago started to identify as disabled. And that was also the case for me. I didn't identify as disabled, I don't think, until I hit college, but I have always been disabled since birth. And like the technical definition of disability, and this is something that is, there's controversy behind it because the disabled community is not a monolith. You know, it encompasses so many people with intersecting identities. And that is something we need to keep in mind. But technically what it is it's a physical or a mental condition that allows for limitations in some capacities with your abilities or what you can do, so on and so forth. But this again is a very debated topic. And so for myself, you know, I have this lymphatic condition and it makes it so that it's very difficult for me to walk. It's difficult for me to, you know, do things that regular kids, quote unquote, I guess could do. And
did you recognize that you had those challenges early on?
So that's the thing. I didn't. Because I think like when you grow up in an able-bodied family, and I love my family, they're very supportive. They did everything they could to get me treatment. along the way, but they also come from this perspective of able-bodiedness. They're healthy, they're fit, they can do whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I was told, you can do whatever you want to do, which is great. Like, we all, you know, should aspire for our dreams. Yeah. Like, that's awesome. But also in doing so, I took on that mindset that then invalidated my own disability, because I was mm-hmm. like, I can do anything. I'm just like everyone else, like, screw lymphedema. Like, I'm just going to do it no matter what. And I then put myself in danger in some situations, you know,
the same with me. And yeah. That's where it resonates so much, because I dismissed it myself, and I dismissed pain at yeah. moment in times yeah. because I was not allowed. And not because my family told me that. I don't, that there's no blame to anyone. It's just because you're like, you can do, it's just, you're born with this and this, it, and that's it. It's just, you have this in. It's awesome to kind of like, kind of grow up with that. But at the same time, it took away the importance of taking care of yourself, or recognizing when you need to stop.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I concur. I completely agree. That was the same for me. Like, I just wanted to so badly be like my peers, that yes. I would do risky things that I knew could put my body, you know, I could develop an infection, so on and so forth. But I yep. was so mm-hmm. dead set on wanting to be like everyone else that I was yeah, like, and- who cares?
Exactly. And for the majority of my life, I tried to be more normal rather than be more of a better lymphedema patient.
Yes.
So everything I did was like, okay, if I am going out and I want to wear a skirt, I need to be wearing my garments so that my legs are, my bandages and garments, so my legs are okay, so I can be that whole night without my my garments.
Yeah.
And then only to enjoy half of the night, because halfway through my feet started swelling so much that I couldn't, my shoes wouldn't fit well. And then they would be just squishing my feet. And it was, and at the end of the night, it was painful. So
yeah,
those, to people able, like you say, able bodies, quote unquote, they don't understand on what level of danger that can be for a lymphedema patient. We're lucky that we're young and our bodies were resilient, or and you know, mm-hmm. we're able to kind of recover from that. But I currently, right now, it would take me weeks to recover from like something like an irresponsibility now like that.
Oh, absolutely. And I often, like, I tell my able-bodied friends this. I'm like, listen, my day cannot begin until I put my compression garments mm-hmm. on. Like, I can't even go to the bathroom, or else I risk, you know, the immediate fluid. It's gravity. It's my enemy mm-hmm. just going to my feet. It's something that I think more able-bodied people can open their eyes up to, like, these perspectives of, this is our reality and this is how we approach it. But absolutely, as a child, you know, you're like, I know I would say to my parents, like, oh my God, I don't want to wear my garments. I'm always wearing them. I don't like them. People make fun of me for them. Like, can I please take them off while we, you know, go to a family friend's house or whatever? And sometimes, you know, parents, it's hard when your child is asking you that. And so my parents would want to give me some leeway and would let me do that. But immediately, you know, 2 hours in, I'd be like, I'm in a lot of pain. Like, everything is now falling apart. This was a mistake. And as you grow up and become an adult, I now know what I need to do with my body. Mm-hmm. But I think absolutely, me as a child separating myself from this idea of being disabled made it so that I was not as compliant of a lymphedema patient, and I wasn't doing what I needed to do for my body. And that, I think, still affects me. I know with my feet are probably the hardest part of my body to manage with lymphedema, just because of gravity. I'm sure you can identify.
They are the worst, but actually we can do a whole podcast about how do you treat different parts of your body, because they're all like particular. People get freaked out because, for example, when I bandage, you know, you have to pay attention to your foot, but at the same time, I don't pay much attention to it either. Like, I try to bandage myself as well as I can, but I know that bandaging is not the best for my foot. It's actually wearing shoes.
Yes. Yes.
Closed shoes. Same. Because then that has all the compression in it. So I'm like, okay, my foot will be a bit swollen. My leg will be better. I'll deal with my foot tomorrow.
Yes, no, exactly. And it's so interesting. And just all of the advice you get because of this lack of knowledge, you know, in the medical community, it's all very convoluted and sometimes contradictory. Like I remember I was told for quite some time that I shouldn't be drinking water because it could worsen my swelling. And then I found out that that was not the case. And hydration is actually a very important part of lymphedema management.
You know, but I was told not to eat that much protein because the lymphatic fluid is that much protein that, and I'm like, that makes no sense because I'm losing a lot of protein. So, and I didn't listen to that, but of course that was wrong information as well.
Oh yeah. There, it's just, it's all so much. It's all very complicated.
Without just keeping it on lymphedema, because that's not the purpose. But I wanted you to explain that way because you talk about a lot about able bodies. And it's a term I've never heard before you said it. And of course it makes sense. And I'll have documents a little bit about it. But does that encompass everyone that does not have a disability?
So my understanding of able-bodiedness, and again, this is something that is really debated within like disability theory among those scholars, is it is someone who does not have a disability, is someone who is not limited by a condition or disease that they have. While for disabled people, there is that limitation in some capacity. There are things to be aware of in order to manage your quality of life, whatever that may be. Right. And it gets there between... Also, disabled people, there is a lot of controversy of how to approach identification because some people prefer first like person language where you say, I'm a person with a disability, as you don't want to be defined first by disability, while others will say they are a disabled person. And I use both. That is something that I've developed in the past few years as I learned more about disability, is it really is up to the person's individual choice of how they want to identify. And I know that's something we wanted to talk about is how do you, you know, talk to someone who's disabled? How should you refer to them as? Yeah. And something I've kind of learned is the best way to go is you should listen to how someone identifies themselves and then mimic that language. So personally, I use both, like I'm a disabled person, but I'm also a person with a disability. I like to switch it up, you know, keep the language going. Well, that might not be the case for everyone. So I think it's just important to keep that in mind when we're discussing disability.
There's been like, because I know there's also kind of confusion about, is disability the correct word? Because are you disabled? Because I know there's been kind of rebrands around the word.
Oh, yeah. Because people don't like the dis part of it, like because it makes it feel like you're inferior in some capacity, like with these limitations. And that is something that a disabled person might, you know, say like, oh, I do not like to be referred to this way. And they will ask you to refer to them as something else. When it comes to that, for me, what I've noticed with this language of like being against the dis and disability is it is often done by able-bodied parents of disabled children who do not want to push that title on their child and they don't want their child to feel limited.
Yes.
And so they say, we don't say disability, like absolutely not. And I know that was something for me when I first started identifying myself as disabled, I would say, you know, to like older relatives, oh yes, I have a disability. And they'd be like, Olivia, how could you say that about yourself?
You don't
like, do
have
not say that. What are you doing?
Yes. Yeah. I've told this to some people because now when I educate people, which is almost on a daily basis, I say, oh, I have a disability. And some people are like, I wouldn't categorize you about because you have a disability, but I'm like, I do. And there's also this misconception. And I think, I don't know what the correct word is, but let's call it misconception about what a disabled person is.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And with disability, like, I think the thing that I try to focus on with that dis, because I absolutely understand, you know, not wanting to make yourself appear limited in some capacity, even though technically we do have limitations we need to respect for our own bodies.
Yeah.
But for me, the disabled part of it is much more tied into society's own workings of ableism. Like I always say, the worst part of my disability, it's not the chronic pain. It's not the consistent like management and treatment and having to be careful all of the time about everything. It's how others view me. Mm-hmm. It's how others, you know, make that effort to see that there is something wrong with me, quote unquote. And they themselves then push their own ableism on me of this idea of like, oh, what's going on with you? That's not normal. And I don't want to be a part of that. So for me, disability, and when I say I'm disabled, I am acknowledging, you know, how my body has limitations, but I'm also mostly acknowledging how society has treated me and how the lack of accommodations and the lack of accessibility in this world that we happen to live in has made it more difficult for me and has created disadvantages. And it does come down to just this ableism, the pervasive ableism, and our collective understanding of that as normal in society. Because you see a disabled person often, like if you were to see someone in a wheelchair, and I know this when I was a child, you know, you're very small. You like to look around. You like to see what's going on. Yeah. You don't know.
Yeah. And then they tell you, don't look. And you're like, yeah, okay, I exactly. can't look. And it's like, and I'm like, no, why do people need to look away when they look at me? As long as they don't look at me in with a weird face and like, yeah, like, of course not.
And like point or whisper, like, exactly. Don't do that. But yeah, I'd be, you know, told like, oh, don't look. It's rude to look. And then when you turn away, if you've made eye contact with a person who is in a wheelchair, for example, and then you immediately turn away because you feel this weirdness and shame, that is so isolating. Absolutely. And invalidating mm-hmm. for that person. Like it makes them feel like they're not worthy of being viewed or just existing in this society. And I think that's something we really, really need to conquer as a community, is just when you see someone who doesn't necessarily look or act the way you expect them to look, you shouldn't just turn to the side and like act like they don't exist. Like, how about you just smile at them and go about your day?
Oh my God. Yes. Yeah. That's exactly what I told somebody that explained, like, then how should I react? I'm like, just smile like you would just to anyone else.
At anyone.
Because you can notice when somebody has looked at you and looked away. Like, I mean, that is more heartbreaking than anything. Look, I lived in New York City. One of the worst experiences is having to hold on to the subway rails. You know, I also live in London. It's similar, but having to hold on, and I needed my left hand because I was using my right hand for something else, because it's more of an able hand than my left. And being ashamed of doing that because I knew how people was going to look at it. And, you know, like, and I got, and either I decided that I didn't care, which is what the route I took a lot of times, but that also is demoralizing sometimes, because sometimes I do care. And what is it that I have a disability and I shouldn't care all the time? Like, come on. Yes. Like, is it me that needs to create the mechanism, or is society that needs to be reformed? Because there is a wrong portrayal of what normal is, because there is a wrong portrayal.
Absolutely. And like, same thing with me and my left hand. It's something I just realized recently. And this kind of ties into when I started to notice that I was different from others as a child, is I was so ashamed of my left hand because it is more swollen than my right. So when I would be in class, I would always keep my left hand under my desk and I would only use my right hand, you know, raise it. So on and so forth. But when it came to writing, my fingers, one, never fully formed properly because of all of the swelling. So it's hard for me to grip a pen. It's hard for me to write, but I would keep my left hand under the desk and write with my right. And so I had nothing to steady me. Yeah. And my handwriting was god awful for like 15 years. And recently, as I've, you know, began to embrace my disability more, I've started to actually ground myself with my left hand and to keep it in sight instead of hiding it. And I've watched my handwriting just improve. I'm it is legible. Like, I'm like, oh, wow, I can write. Good it's job, not just Olivia. Chicken scratch.
Good job.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm really trying, you know. But that was an interesting thing where I'm like, wow, you know, you continue to try to hide these parts of yourself, and that only further like negatively impacts who you are and what you're doing, so on and so forth. And one that I always really remember to connect us back to, like the idea of able-bodiedness and how able-bodied people might view those with disabilities. This was a big moment for me when I was 5 years old. My family went to Disneyland, as families with small kids do. And I was all wrapped up. My legs were wrapped up just because, you know, it's hot. There's going to be a lot of walking. We wanted to make sure that my lymphatic system was being managed as it needed to. And so we had actually gotten a wheelchair for me just because the park, it's so expansive. And as you know, at some point when you have lymphedema, you get really, really tired after you've been walking. It gets very painful. Like,
and
I'm
a
small child.
They did the correct thing. Because we didn't do that for me, because again, I never put limitations on myself, and I thought it's like, oh, it's only swelling, whatever, which is not only swelling. And that really affected me. I remember finishing a day at a park in Disneyland when I've been, and like my legs would be, and I wouldn't be wearing my garments, of course, because I didn't want to. And it was not nice.
No, definitely not. You're all bloated and like with the rides and everything. I mean, I ended up learning a few years later that rides are a no-no. I'm not allowed to go on them because they kept giving me.
I don't know about this. No, don't tell me this.
Oh, you don't want to know. All I will say is a few roller coasters at multiple points in my life put me in the hospital with cellulitis lymphangitis.
No
and so,
way.
Yeah, when I was in seventh grade, I got another bout of it. And my doctor was like, you are not allowed on roller coasters ever again. And I was heartbroken because I loved roller coasters.
I love it too. I'm an adrenaline junkie.
Same. But all of the like the G's and going up and down and the like the swirls, it confuses your lymphatic system. And so it caused mine to panic. And just, I would get a really bad bacterial infection. It happened to be on my 7th birthday. My mom took me to Legoland. And as we're leaving the park, you know, the redness begins, the heat, I can't walk. And
oh
that was
God,
it.
I'm sorry. I didn't know, so, but you just broke my heart too. I'm going to,
I'm so sorry. You can act like you've never heard it. I was advised. And so now I have to respect what I was advised by my doctor. But anyway, yeah, roller coasters are a no. But to go back to this moment, at Disneyland. So I'm 5 years old. I'm in a wheelchair and my parents are pushing me around and we're going to the rides. And because I was in a wheelchair, you know, we had like one of the disability passes so that you can skip the line and just go right ahead, which is so, so helpful to many people, especially myself with lymphedema. Like I cannot stand in a line. That is my literal nightmare, having to stand in a line for hours. Cause once again, gravity, it's the enemy. But I'm in this wheelchair. We're going on like Magic Mountain or something. We get to the front of the line and I hopped out of the wheelchair to get into, you know, the roller coaster. And I was feeling all good. I'm five. I'm like all wrapped up, but very excited for Magic Mountain. And we get off the ride, come back. And my dad ended up coming to talk to me. And he's like, hey, like next time when we, you know, get out of the wheelchair after going to the front of the line, I think we need to not be so like jumping out, because I got a lot of dirty looks from those around me, like the older people, because they assumed that I was faking, my disability in some capacity. They're like, they just want to skip the line. Like she just jumped right out of the wheelchair. This is ridiculous. And so I ended up having to like act more disabled while we were at Disneyland, simply so that I and my family would not be judged or, you know, whispered about by those around us, because they were being pretty mean.
Yeah.
Like they saw my ability to stand out of the wheelchair and was like, faker, she's a faker, so she shouldn't get to do this, so on and so forth. And that is often the case with disability. It's so interesting because the idea of disability in general, I think, makes a lot of able-bodied people feel uncomfortable, especially if they have not had to interact with it in their own lives.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But then often they expect you to not share your own experiences with them because it furthers their uncomfortability.
Yeah.
And that in itself is so interesting. This idea of having to portray myself as a child, as more disabled, when I was period disabled, that's it.
Like having to look sick, because what does sick look like? Because disability actually, it does not equal sick.
No.
is two different things, and sickness, it's a terrible word to describe any of what we have. It's not sickness nor illness.
No, never. And that was something like throughout my life, you know, didn't identify as disabled until I started taking disability study college classes in college. But, you know, as a child, I was so nervous of being perceived in that way of disabled that I would go out of my way, one, to not do that, except for when I had to, mm-hmm. like at Disneyland, in order to just be able to make it around the park for the day. Mm-hmm. But then in my real life, like I would not ask for accommodations. I would not
ever
ask, because I was just so embarrassed. I was so ashamed. I was like, I don't want to ask for this. I don't want to be different from my peers. Like, and I know a big thing for me, I don't know if you dealt with this, was I was wearing the wrong structure of compression garments up until 2022, the age of 22. And so my garments on my legs would always slip down to my knees and then they would cut off circulation. And so as a child, I would ask my teachers to go to the bathroom a lot just so I could go and pull everything back up. And that started to irritate my teachers. Like they started to be like, why can't you just do this in the classroom? And I would try to explain, well, it means I have to pull my pants down and then I have to pull them back up and so on and so forth. And I don't feel comfortable doing that in a classroom. But because it became this inconvenience for my teachers of, oh, there's this one student who is always going to the bathroom and her classmates are seeing that she's always allowed to go to the bathroom, it became very convoluted. And so I, at the age of like 9 or 10, was just so over having to deal with asking to go to the bathroom and getting flack back that I just stopped doing it. And so my compression garments from like 10 to 20 were consistently slipping, cutting off circulation in my knees. And, you know, then it accumulates down in your calves and in your feet. And I would get home at the end of the day and everything will just be ballooned below my knees. Mm-hmm. And it's so, so painful. Well, but because I was so ashamed, I couldn't ask anymore. I couldn't do it.
Yeah, no. And shame is a horrible feeling. I can tell you so many situations. The only, what I wanted to say about that is that you were braver than me because you were wearing the garments. I didn't wear garments for years in my high school years. I was like, hell no, I'm not going to do that. And of course that affected me a lot. And that's where my story kind of catapults in my 20s because I was not taking care of myself. I was taking care of myself how I wanted to take care of myself, not how I should, just because there was a lot of shame around it. I didn't want to be pointed out to be the different one. And I made it a thing. Till to this day, I make it a thing that I don't allow people to adjust to me. I don't like it. It makes me extremely uncomfortable. Not sure if that correct or right. It's also me and the way I am, but that strings along from that thought of like, I cannot accept or like you could not say I'm disabled because not that anybody tried, but in my brain, because I'm not. Yeah. And yeah, I put myself in dangerous situations. Like you said, like I didn't take care of myself the way I should. And like that, I can think of so many situations. Like as you were telling that story, I'm like, oh my God, it reminds me of so many of mine.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many. And like, I don't know, maybe for you, I had a big thing with like physical education classes, like the US, you have to do PE. Like that is mandated.
We did too in Puerto Rico.
And oh boy, was it not great for me because I, you know, I wanted to keep up with my peers. Mm-hmm. And so I was running after them, playing all of the games. And I often would not tell like my PE coaches that I had, you know, a disease that they needed to be aware of in any capacity because I would just, I kept it so private and to myself. Like my parents would tell my teachers at the beginning of the year. And then I would avoid all possible conversations surrounding it. But with, you know, PE coaches, I would just go about the physical education classes as my friends were. And I ended up having asthma attacks. I ended up like collapsing while trying to run laps. And it was a nightmare. And my coaches would be like, why didn't you tell me?
Yeah.
And it was, you know, that ingrained shame of, I don't want to be perceived differently. And I want to be able to be a part of this with all of my classmates. But also it's wild how much we have to advocate for ourselves. Just for the littlest things. Like as a 6-year-old, I shouldn't have been having to like beg to use the restroom. Yeah. Like it's things like that where it becomes so hard, and the advocacy, it never stops.
No, it doesn't. And look, in terms of the generic consensus that I've got, right, because there's no one size fits all to fix all these things that we're talking about. There is a lack of empathy in the generic sense. Absolutely. For everything, right? For everything. Just by being more empathetic, and if somebody's asking themselves, how do I fix it? Do exactly the opposite of what you're doing. So rather than look away, give a smile. Rather than immediately think of the bad thing of like, this person is trying to cheat the system and trying to cut the line in Disney. Think about, what does that kid or that family need? Or do actually they need assistance in getting their kid off that chair? Or maybe think, oh, it's great that person is so enthusiastic and they need to be in a wheelchair. You know, like the other opposite of like, it just these little things just in the brain and changing that mindset and that perspective just goes a long way. Because again, it is ingrained in all of us to the extent that it's ingrained in us as disabilities.
Yeah. And that's because, you know, society, we see disability as very negative. I mean, there in the media, you're not going to find a lot of representation where disability is just painted as something normal for someone and it's okay. It's always a sob story.
It's always a tragedy. And that's something I've very much stayed away from. I like to touch these topics. I like to talk about it and I'm going to talk about them, but it is not only a tragedy.
Yes. And to continue to paint it as a tragedy, like it goes back to, you know, telling someone you're disabled and them being like, no, you're not. Don't say that about yourself. Like they associate disability with misery in a weird way. Like the two words become synonymous. And that should not be the case because once again, the most disabling thing about disability is society's ableism, is the inaccessibility that we face and have to literally make leaps over in order to just get the bare minimum. It's wild.
Yeah. Girl. And look, I don't want to segue too much into this because it is currently happening to me, but the hardest time, you know, I've always had a hard time with it and accepting it and accepting the limitations. Most of the people that know me, even in my college years, would never tell you that I missed a class or didn't do something because of my lymphedema. I would push myself. And that really got me into trouble with my health in the future. Now, not going into those moments. At work, since I started working 10 years ago, I did the same thing, right? I can only tell you, Olivia, that the only time I accepted disability was out of a conveniency. And it's only happening, that was when I was starting to accept it. And it's because I saw that I was also being stupid by not accepting it because there were schemes and things to help me. And when I noticed that I could get a disability pass to be parking close to my classroom, I mean, of course, but people don't know how much I was walking in 100 degree Fahrenheit, 35, 40 Celsius weather in Puerto Rico with my legs, like, which are more effective with the heat. I was walking for 30 minutes to get to classrooms sometimes. And imagine, like, you looked at me like, oh my God, panic attack. Yes, because that's horrible. Today, I only walk that amount because it's a nice weather outside in London and it's not in that heat. And anyway, I sometimes wearing double compression to do it. So even those, like you say, those simple things are so important. And now at work, I acted the same way. And what happened, what I noticed is also this phobia that I have about accepting it, because then it was going to limit me in my career path, because I felt that if I said something transparently, I was going to be told, oh, maybe because Nicole cannot do it because maybe Nicole needs to stay at home today. And I was like, I was just asking at a moment in time for flexible working for work from home. And I was not giving it. One time I was questioned why, like, do you really, because when I started taking care of myself better, I was doing bandaging at 7 a.m. to, I get out of the therapist at 9 and I would just get at home at 9:30. So I was just asking for a 9:30 start on one day a week and stay at home and work from home. It was totally normal. And most of people said yes, but one of my managers was like, do you really need to stay at home? Can you come to work that day? Because you need to do this and this and this. And I'm like, it's your problem right now that you cannot enable me with the tools that you need because there's a problem. I told you that I need this and it is quite demoralizing. I don't know what other words to say, that you're questioning my need to be at home because you don't know what it is to come to work in bandages. And I actually did, Olivia, once, because sometimes I have big ovaries and I just did. And I went and I said, you know what? I'm going to demonstrate to this asshole. That's why I need to be at home. And I went to the office and I actually should be doing this more often, but it's very difficult and it's warm and I needed to get into this stupid subway to get here. Because are you paying for my Uber back and forth? I don't think so. So I've never been using aggression for education, but at some point I've had to, because it needs to people understand. Yes, some people might make excuses for stupid things, but you also need to be empathetic about the people that are actually not making excuses and they need to. Yes. Many times I've seen people kind of quickly judge this person is missing work or this person is not. And then it's really like, oh, they're underperforming. Oh, they're not doing their job properly. Have you thought or asked what is happening and can I help?
Yes, absolutely. Everything you just said, like I completely concur, because, you know, when you are a child with a disability, there is that idea of being a burden. And I was so worried at every moment of being a burden to anyone around me, to my family, to my peers, to my teachers, whoever it may be. And so I took in expecting the worst for myself and just dealing with it. Like the lack of accommodations. I didn't ask for anything. I just let it happen. I consistently lived in pain. I was often pretty miserable. You know, I was being bullied. There was a lot going on. And I was just like, this is the state of life. And this is what I'm going to deal with, because to ask for more could just make it so much worse. And so something for me is actually during this pandemic, when remote work became mandated, I all of a sudden was like, this is wild. Like I am able to work from home and I don't have to wake up, you know, at 7 a.m. and go through and do like putting on my garments and moisturizing and everything like that. And then rushing to the train and jumping on the train and hoping that there's a seat available for me, but also being prepared to stand for 50 minutes because people don't see young people as disabled and they won't give up their seat. So on and so forth. Right. And so during this remote period, I was like, this is a whole new realm for me. Like I learned that I don't, because it's, I mean, you start at the age of 5, you're going to school 5 days a week and you're very busy and you have extracurriculars. So I was like, this is the standard where I'm just always moving. And when it came to work, I was like 9 to 5, 5 days a week in office, here we go. And I didn't realize how negatively that was affecting my body until all of a sudden remote work was a possibility. And I was able to elevate while I'm sending emails and I can use my compression pump while I'm, you know, on a Zoom call, so on and so forth. And it changed everything for me. But then my office was like, we're coming back to work full time. And I was like, no.
Oh, no, like, you don't.
Please don't do this to me, because I finally, for the first time in 24 years, had gotten a manage on my lymphedema, because mine, it's so extreme. Mm-hmm. It moves so quickly. Like I've been told by doctors that I can't be out of garments for 10 minutes, you know, without there mm-hmm. being these negative consequences. And so when my office said we're going back to work full time, it was the first time I ever asked for an accommodation.
Well, I'm glad that you did. I'm glad that you did. I'm very proud of
Thank
you for doing it.
Yeah. It takes a lot, because, you know, when you are just used to not asking for anything and just accepting the conditions as they are, like to have to then go in and go to your supervisor and be like, please, and then have to lay out all of the information as to why you need this accommodation is exhausting. It's very emotionally draining. And it brings up once again that, you know, thought of I am a burden and I, you know, need all of this. And not everyone wants to grant it. So I think that's something really important to keep in mind, is we have seen during this pandemic that there are these accommodations available. Employers can be making things more accessible for those who have conditions, disabilities, otherwise to live their lives. But we weren't doing that before because we never center disabled voices in anything we're doing.
Absolutely. And it is completely, it creates a completely equal playing field for the first time. Look, the only way I created an equal playing field for myself was pushing away my disability and actually putting my health at risk, which I did. And I programmed myself that sometimes I might need to do that in order to grow in my career or in order to get to the next step. And then I would probably get to a state of burnout, which has happened in my life around 4 to 5 times, that then I have to take myself out of the world to then readjust and then go back in. And that's not a way to live. And that shouldn't be normal. And that shouldn't be expected. And what I completely concur with what you're saying, what the pandemic has done is to democratize the workplace, because we only have one way and one way only, this way, virtual, and the same amount of time in the calendar. I mean, if you want to stay for 12 hours, you can stay for 12 hours, but in the equal playing field, not because you are able to walk more or able to stay at the office more because your body allows it, because your finances allowed it. I'm not only talking in this scenario about disabilities, because your family structure allows it. Maybe you have a different family structure and you need to be at home at a certain time. It's not the case with this remote working. And the moment they told me I have to go back to work, I was very, like, I had a trauma response towards it, because I was like, then it means I need to start pushing my body again to limits that I shouldn't, in order to live my full potential of my intellect. So then that means that the system and the world is perpetuating me to not live to my potential, because physically I cannot do it the way that able body, like you say, world expecting me to do it. For example, I work in a consulting firm in corporate America, and in this moment in corporate UK, and in order for you to get ahead, you probably need to go to those happy hours after work, or you probably need to go to those extracurricular events, because that's what you need to do. Fine, fair enough. But that would mean that I'm pushing myself to an extra limit that I might not be able to get back. And if you're expected to do that in order to grow, is that really an unwritten rule? Because if I'm not in that happy hour, I'm not going to get that visibility or that ability to kind of go ahead or meet that person that I needed to meet or see that person in the face. No, that shouldn't be the case, because we all should have an equal playing field. It should really be equal, and it has not been. Equality does not mean to have a headcount of disabled people or people of color or whatever that means, or a headcount of women. No, that's not equality. It's really providing to your people a way to actually execute the job equally.
Yes, no, absolutely. And I mean, just with the concept of work, I watched this disabled activist who talks a lot about disability, especially in the workplace and in healthcare. She had made this video, and I did not know this before, but often on job applications in the United States, they will ask you if you are able to lift 25 plus pounds of so on, so forth, whatever, for the job. And they'll also ask you if you're able to drive. And they will say that these are prerequisites of the job, usually when they are not, for the most part. And I ended up finding out from this activist, Amani Barberin, that the reason that these standards exist on job applications is because they work as a barrier from disabled people to enter the workforce. Oh, wow. Basically, if someone says, you know, I can't lift 25 plus pounds, or I am unable to drive, then those applications get thrown out pretty immediately. I mean, we know we have these like systems that can go through applications and sort them into the trash based on whatever has been selected. And so in the United States, these job applications will have these prerequisites for the job that are not actually needed. And what it ends up doing is it decreases the amount of disabled applicants that you have in your job pool. And that in turn helps make it so that companies' healthcare premiums are lower, so that companies are having to pay less, because disability often is more expensive, as you know, in the medical field. It becomes this huge disadvantage and just this huge barrier for disabled people to be able to work. And then, of course, in the US, it's all a nightmare no matter what, in terms of, you know, disabled people and the poverty line and that intersection there, because, you know, with SSI benefits, so on and so forth, like all of these inaccessible pathways that we just continue to make more inaccessible as this way of keeping disabled people out of the public view. It's very, very interesting. And it's also just horrible. It's ableism in itself, which once again shows, like, disability at the end of the day, the most disabling part of it is how able-bodiedness makes us feel and how we are categorized based on that. So I've been thinking a lot about what Imani said, because that just, it opens up the idea of the US, you know, work system is not a place for disabled people. And so for us, when we have to work to pay bills, they make it so that we in ourselves have such a difficult time doing the job, because they don't want to give these accommodations for all of these bureaucratic reasons. And once I learned that, I was like, oh boy, we need to change the entire system, don't we? Like, it just all needs to be reconstructed.
No, and absolutely. And I think that's why I break it down to a very simple thing, which is empathy, because there's a lot to do there. I'm not expecting to change the world. I'm not expecting, I mean, one thing at a time, but I think we can all start from ourselves and our terminology and the way we speak and how we address people, so that, and how do we teach others as well? If you're recognizing it yourself, how do you teach others? Yeah. Because you can make the difference to a couple of people at work.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I do it on a daily basis at work before thinking or suspecting this person is not doing a bad job. I do it on the opposite. It's like, do you need help and how can we support you? Because I know that those words go an extra mile, and very few people have asked me about it. I've had wonderful people support me, by the way. Like, I cannot complain about that, but I've had very tough situations as well that I've had to deal with. And I just wanted to approach kind of, when did I accept my disability as a disability? Because it's two different moments. It's time when I accepted my lymphedema and when I actually accepted that it was a disability. And after a couple of years after accepting my lymphedema, when I did get to the UK to work, which is a bit of a parallel time frame when I kind of went through my acceptance journey, which was way later than you in your time frame, Olivia. So I really respect you a lot for that. I said that I was not going to make the same mistake that I did when I was working in New York, that I was really going to advocate for myself. Because ultimately, I do think we shouldn't take away that advocating for yourself. That I think that should be true for everyone, regardless abled or disabled. I think that should be normalized, actually, because also not everybody can assume what you're going through or what you're not. It's the acceptance of the advocacy that needs to be, that's where the empathy needs to be, right? But when I got here, I like I said, I promised myself I was not going to do X, Y, Z, and exactly I got here. The first opportunity was traveling for my job and staying in a hotel. And food is a huge part of my life in terms of how I eat. It really affects me. And by not having my food, what happened is I feel ill. Like, I literally got sick, and I, like, for a week I couldn't go to work. So I had to then start food prepping on a Sunday to take that food with me and store it in the fridge of the office of that company that was like 3 hours away, to eat that food from Monday to Thursday. So, you know, I had to adjust to it, and I kept adjusting to it. And then the next role that I had was 3 hours away, but commuting. So I was in commuting for all that time, and I decided that I, because the opportunity was good and it was going to get me a promotion probably, etc. And you know what? Thank God, eventually it did, but it put my body onto a lot of stress.
Yeah.
And after all that happened, I, like I said, I went into a burnout. I had to take myself away and I had to go to Germany to the clinic for 7 weeks to kind of get back to normal, quote unquote. And and I came back and I said, no, I'm going to embrace it firsthand. And for the first time, they do those introductions at work. And it's like, what do you do? And tell me a fun fact about yourself. And I'm like, it's not really a fun fact, but I'm going to use it. And I said, well, you're going to see myself wearing a garment. Don't be alarmed. It's not a fashion choice, although it, these days it,
it is,
I said.
Fashion show.
Now it is a fashion choice. But I have a condition of the lymphatic system. I'm very passionate about it and I'm happy to talk to anyone that wants to talk about it. But yeah, that's a part of my life since birth. I said something like that and you immediately feel the inadequacy of some of the energies in the room, right?
Oh yeah.
I think it's something to, I've got used to it because also my spiel is, it's a bit more comfortable, but I've had to do those adjustments and that advocacy for myself. Again, I don't think it's something that we shouldn't be doing, but the more that moment in time is more accepted and more empathetic others towards you, it's the more that we're all going to be also more comfortable in doing it. Because that took me 31 years to do. 31. And I still, it's difficult. Now I just approach it pretty well. But for example, the other day I had COVID and I was still working and I did it for my mental health. It wasn't, you know, it helped me. But immediately I was giving all this work and I was questioned about something I didn't do or whatever, which was a stupid thing. And I got so angry. This was not lymphedema related, but I had COVID. Like nobody thought like, oh, Nicole has COVID, so maybe we need to give this to somebody else or whatever. So I literally lashed out. I'm like, are you forgetting that I am sick? Like, regardless if now COVID is normal or not, I don't care. I was still sick. It's like, I'm not like questioning you because you're sick or not. And all of this is so, it's so much bigger than disabilities, but it, you know, disabilities really suffer from it so much.
Oh yeah. Absolutely. And I think like with these accommodations and with COVID, especially, we are living, you know, in this timeline, which is a mass disabling event. We are seeing people who have had COVID develop long COVID, and we don't know what that will look like for the rest of their lives. We're seeing a lot of really, you know, interesting symptoms and side effects of COVID. And if we as a society can just make ourselves and the public and private spheres more accommodating to those with disabilities, that helps everyone in the long run.
Everyone.
Able-bodied people included, because as we live through this mass disabling event and see more and more people becoming disabled, if we have these accommodations already set forth and already have this mindset of being accessible, that will help us. But because we, especially in the United States where I am, live in this world where disability is such a, so taboo and such a no-no, and we don't have these accommodations, we're only making it harder for ourselves and for future generations to actually just survive, just to be able to do it. And we honestly need to rethink how we've structured society, how we've structured the workday, because as it currently is, it is only making it more difficult for people to live their lives, especially when they have a disability. It just, we'd go so much farther if we were more accepting.
Yeah, and it basically, what the system is telling me to do is like, oh, good job, Nicole. You have all this and you're still able to do this corporate normal job, but then you need to use all your weekend to recover and do all your errands. So so then I'm not meant to enjoy my weekend, right? Because those 2 days I need to kind of like recover for the work week. What life is that? So what are you telling me then? That I shouldn't be working? Oh, okay, fine. Are you going to pay me my salary? No, I don't think so. So how do you enable these things for the collective? That's it. Because it's not only us, Olivia. I'm pretty sure.
No.
I'm, I can tell you I've had this conversation with parents, with people that, I don't know, they want not to live in the city center. They have different, they need to take care of family members. And like it all becomes more complicated when you actually more simple. Yeah. When you look at it like that, because it's not only able body to disabled body, it's just that we were living very unattainable circumstances. And yep. Basically everybody can recognize that they're probably all on the path to burnout, which, you know, eventually can result in a disability or can result in an actual illness or, you know, many other things. So yeah, this topic is broad and clearly we're passionate about it.
Oh yeah. There's so much to say. I mean, there's just so much to discuss. I mean, because like I look at the workday and, you know, you end at 5, you commute home, usually get home around 6. You have to make yourself dinner. You have to do whatever chores need to be done around the home. So you've got like a bit of time there. But also if you just want to take a breath, like that's time you have to factor in too, of like maybe watching TV. And then for us, like I know I have to take a shower around 8 o'clock because then I need to get into my bed and I need to do MLD and I need to moisturize my entire body. Mm-hmm. And that is a very long process. And if you're bandaging, add another hour and 30 minutes onto that because we have to bandage all of our extremities.
Yeah, well, you have one more than me, which is very strange to say. I'm usually the most bandaged person in the room, but you're more bandaged than me.
I got you beat. What can I say?
It's like I told somebody, they don't really know much lymphedema people. And I'm like, well, I've met a lot of people and in the clinics and whatever, but there's only one negative thing about going, you don't feel that special anymore.
Yes. No, absolutely. That was the thing for me when I first, you know, wrote my blog piece and all of a sudden was swept into the lymphy community. I was like, I love this because I've always wanted to find community. Like I've always felt alone, but also this is a little weird because this has been my thing for my entire life. And all of a sudden, you know what I'm talking about? Like, wait,
no way. I'm not that special. No way. No, take that back. In that arena, Olivia, I kind of wanted you to tell me a little bit about this, your Germany experience, just because I talked about it a lot. For me, it was a different moment in my life than it was for mm-hmm. you. And it mm-hmm. was wonderful. But you said a lot of things about it that resonated a lot, but not only from Germany, just from my whole journey as a disabled person going mm-hmm. to doctors and feeling like a specimen. Yep. And you describe it pretty well. And I wanted you to kind of tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So feeling like a guinea pig, feeling like a specimen, I mean, that's like second nature to me at this point from all of the doctor's appointments, because we do require a lot of treatment and there's a lot of management, but there's also, you know, this lack of information and lack of mm-hmm. medical knowledge. So for all doctors, you know, usually I'd walk in and have to explain everything about me to the doctor, and then it would become very invalidating. But with Germany specifically, I went to the clinic after I graduated college. So I was 22 and I went for a 6-week stint, and it was a very, very difficult 6 weeks mm-hmm. For a lot of reasons. One, I had just graduated from college. And so, you know, that's a big thing. Like you're off into the new world. And I know a lot of my friends post-college, they like went on trips together. Mm-hmm. Like they went around the world. They went to Europe. They did this. And I also went to Europe, but I went to go to this very intensive medical treatment for 6 weeks. And Germany, it changed my life. Like I do not at all regret my experience going there because it was so necessary. And I know I will go back in the future if I can ever afford to, given it is very, very expensive non-German patients to go there. But with Germany, it was interesting because I throughout college had taken disability studies classes and I would become a lot more open-minded about disability. I started identifying as disabled. I was like, we are embracing disability. I am over this negative rhetoric surrounding it. Like I need to embrace this for myself. And so I left college with that really awesome mindset. And then I went to Germany. And of course, like with our lymphedema, it's very rare. It's very extreme. It moves very quick and there is not a lot that can be done for it. I know I've applied to like countless clinical trials that are looking to cure lymphedema and I always get denied because I have too much lymphedema and I'm like, okay, that's the case.
I did too, Olivia, believe me. Yeah. And I went to assessments of surgeries. I'm not applicable to any, not that I wanted to, but I wanted a bit of more reaction from the doctors. And it was like, sorry, not enough technology for you. Bye.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just, it's heartbreaking because, you know, you put your effort into that and you get a little bit of hope that maybe there'll be something that'll just not even cure because we know we can't be cured. Just lessen it. Exactly. But I got to Germany and I was one, the only American there, which was very interesting. And I think a very positive experience for me to have because not often are you the only American in a room, especially if you live in America. So that was like a new experience for me. But also I was one of the youngest people there. Like most, there are older women. And so I felt weirdly like a little isolation. It kind of like I would sit in the cafeteria and I'd be like, oh goodness, is this high school all over again? Like there are these little cliques of like old lymphedema women.
Those German women can be clicky, man.
They are clicky, but they also were fascinated with me. I had so many of them just come up and kiss me on the cheek and give me a hug and they'd be like, American. And I'd be like, America. Yeah, that's me. Yeah. But with what I noticed with the doctors is they, because I, you know, present lymphedema in this very extreme and rare way, they were fascinated with my body and with the way I operated. And so something that I would deal with, and it's hard to deal with when you're 22 and you're alone and you're in this clinic in a foreign country, is there was a lot of like, you know, touching, trying to look at the different parts of my body. And they would often speak in German. So I wouldn't know what was necessarily going on. And I just sit there like, God, I hope I'm not dying. Like, I hope they'll tell me if I'm dying because they just, you know, talk around me. And with the German dialect, it's a lot more blunt and aggressive. So I was like, is this bad news? Like, what's happening? But they would then, you know, turn to me and tell me, and they'd be like, your lymphedema is really, really bad. Like your situation is the worst. You basically need to be wrapped up or compressed 24/7. You shouldn't be going to the beach. Like you shouldn't be doing this, 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 this. And all of a sudden I had, you know, developed this mindset of trying to be a lot more accepting of my disability and being like, yes, I have limitations, but I'm making it work for myself. And I'm still able to enjoy my life as it is. And all of a sudden that was just crushed.
Yeah.
By like all of these doctors gathering around and telling me all of the things that were wrong with my body, which I already knew, like, mind you, like I'd had a lot of doctors
you're pretty aware.
Already tell me that. Trust me, I know what's wrong with me. I am very aware. I have a list. But that in itself was just kind of heartbreaking because I felt myself folding back into that ingrained idea of like, this is terrible. There is no positive upside. Like the way I exist is awful. And that's being shown like through these medical professionals. And I think that is a big thing to talk about with disability is there is the medical model of disability.
Absolutely.
And then there's
the
social model of disability. And we gravitate towards the medical model because we as a society are focused on the idea of curing. Like we need to fix this huge problem when in reality, we should be looking at a social model of disability, which is surrounding acceptance and empathy and accommodations and so on and so forth. But with doctors, which is very understandable, given, you know, they have gone through all of this schooling and they are focused on trying to cure things and, you know, make the patient's quality of life better. But they also get really stuck in this idea. In the science of this very negative thing. And here's all of the things that are wrong, so on so forth. And it's just really dehumanizing to hear all of that. And so I definitely felt like a specimen, but I also, you know, come out of that knowing that that was a really big growth opportunity for me. Like, of course, my mental health when I left was not great. It took a lot to kind of build myself back up to be accepting of my disability in the way I had learned to. But at the same time, I also came away from this experience with the best compression garments I've ever had.
Yeah.
And with like a lot of really important knowledge that doctors in the United States just simply don't have and couldn't give me. And so that was really, really important. But at the same time, it was like my mental health suffered for the benefit of my physical health.
Yeah.
And that's not good because the two need to work together.
Absolutely.
Yeah. When your mental health suffers, like I know for me, as a child, I was very touch adverse because so many did not want to touch me. They saw my condition as contagious. And so I became really, I just didn't like my body. I loathed it. And so I was not taking care of it. Like I refused to like even perform any MLD because I was so disgusted with my body. And so kind of that same thing happened when I came away from Germany, where I once again was like disgusted with my state of being, which is not good for compliance because a lot of compliance is doing MLD and is, you know, moving the fluid, massaging, so on and so forth. And so that was really interesting. And I think that's something in the medical system we can continue to explore is this idea of really incorporating your social model. And I'd say over your medical model, because the medical model in itself is really just ingrained in ableism. And we just need to move away from it. Like it's just time.
Look, and all of it, and I'm sorry that you had to go through that. And, you know, it resonates so much, Olivia, because every time I've been to not only that clinic, I've been to other clinics. I've been in total to clinics probably like 9 times in my life. Mm-hmm. Every time, except the last couple, because my life changed and it's a different part of my life. You're younger. And I believe me, when I was around your age, every time I came out of the clinic, I didn't come out happier. Yeah. I came out way more aware of what I had, but not in the positive angle. And that's why all of this resonated so much, because the same of what we're saying at work and people being empathy, it needs to be applied in whatever diagnosis you get. I don't know what it is with other diagnoses and something I would need to explore. I've had this conversation with other people, but I've had this conversation a lot with lymphedema patients, and it is all about a restrictive nature and not adjusted nature, which is what I talk about, right? Like this is what this space is about. I took those words of like, you shouldn't do this and this and this and no sauna, no bar, and no what. And I'm like, no. It might mean less of this. It might mean more of this. But I created my own model because I knew inside that half of that thing does not make sense, that I have an experience in my body different, and that by creating, by providing a verbiage of restriction, it was creating a bad reaction in me, because that's why I was not compliant for so many years. Because I'm like, what are you saying makes no sense? And that doesn't allow me to live my life. How, like, compression 24/7? That's not possible. I'm sorry. It is not.
No.
I'm sorry. First of all, it's my skin cannot tolerate it. I get like rashes if I do that. And like, you just have to do whatever you can do, but that's not encouraged. It's giving it in a different way. And you're right. You're totally right. I think also there's, I believe me, I've been to that clinic in Germany like 4 times now. And now I laugh about it because the translation is not correct. And like you say, you're like, oh, you're so bad. And maybe they don't try to say you're so bad. Like, because in the world of lymphedema, you look at me and people are like, oh, but she's okay. But they don't know what's going in. Is that I am in a correct and a good state. But my insides are pretty fucked up. So, you know, and the same with you. So I do now understand what they were trying to say. But for example, like my therapist, which by the way, I adore and love, she would use words like so extreme case like you, so extreme case. And now I laugh about it because, you know, I can. But to listen to that at a moment in time is like you said, dehumanizing is like extreme case. Like, but yes, I wanted you to tell that story so people know what it is also to get a diagnosis and process it. And that's why it's not easy. And even any doctors listening is like, however you can speak to a person in an proactive way, not in an even more disabling way, it goes a long way. Because now patients like us look for other patients to see how do you manage, because none of us trust most doctors.
Yep.
Because not only they cannot give us information, they give us quite limiting information, and that doesn't seem like possible, right? Or even feasible.
So, absolutely.
Thank you for being so honest with all that.
Oh yeah. And something else that it just popped into my head that I remember though, is I had been really excited about the clinic because they offered like a psychology sort of aspect. Like I'd read that on the website. And so when I got there, I ended up asking about it. I was like, I would love to talk to the psychologist or like go to the group therapy session, whatever is going on there. And I ended up being told by one of the doctors that that was not for me. Like that was those who aren't being compliant, aren't being good lymphedema patients, so on and so forth. They were like, you don't need that. Like that's for those who are not doing what they need to do. And I was like, oh no. Like, well, one, I'm glad you think I'm being compliant because I am, like, just because otherwise I would be in excruciating pain. I've known this since I was a toddler.
In a way, but it was like, oh, thanks for the compliment.
Yeah. But also I think it could be really helpful to have, you know, these psychology groups where we can talk about it and have a support group. And that was interesting to me. I'm like, we really need to start intersecting mental health and physical health because the two affect each other. Stress affects lymphedema. We know this.
Absolutely. And look, I don't think I talk about it enough because it's my life. Like, I've been in counseling for 10 years now. It's part of my life. It's part of my livelihood and my well-being, like to have my psychologist. I've needed psychiatrists in the past because I've been in dark places, on dark stages, and I'm very open about it all, about the whole aspect of mental health. But I don't think it clicks in people's brains sometimes, and it is very put away because people don't want to deal with the emotional aspect. And like you say, wants to do things to cure, like a pill. And for me, one of the things that made my lymphedema better was to treat my mental health. I was having this conversation with a person that I will interview later on in the podcast. And he's like, what is worse, the mental or the physical? I'm like, for me, it's a chicken and egg. It's literally both, because one fed the other.
Yep.
And then the opposite. And like, uncompliance fed me feeling worse, and feeling worse fed hating myself, and hating myself fed not thinking that anything I could do would do anything, and and that mental health angle, it's something we really need to work on.
Absolutely. And I think maybe you also understand this experience, but when you're a child with, you know, a disability, with a condition where you have to do more in order to just get by. I know I was fed a lot the line of, you're so resilient. And so I really took pride in that. I was like, I'm so resilient. I don't ask for anything ever. And that makes me less of a burden. And I'm just going to continue on with that. But resilience at the end of the day, like that was just me dealing with trauma, but not being prepared to deal with said trauma, just like allowing it to happen. And, you know, it stirs deep in my insides and I kept it there and nothing else happened.
Yeah.
Exactly. Because that's what you know to do. And you don't want to make those around you uncomfortable. Once again, with able-bodied people feeling uncomfortable when disability is brought into the conversation. And now I'm just like, I scream from the rooftops, like, oh, I have a disability. Does that make you uncomfortable? Great. Let me tell you everything I can possibly tell you about it until you run away from me. Like, what can we do?
Yeah, no, I love it. And with that, the last topic to close that I wanted to cover is your acceptance journey. You said that you went through the period of like finally accepting, but then getting down and again, kind of clinging on your resilience to get you back up and being more true to your disability. But there's also another angle to your persona and your personal life that I think it's wonderful to talk about a little bit, because you're a wonderful world of the queer community.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I would love to talk about this.
Yeah, I wanted you to talk about it because I don't think there are many people hear both sides.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Let's get into it. I love the intersection between queerness and disability. It's my favorite topic. I've written a lot of papers on it. So I am a lesbian. And of course, you know, I see sexuality as something that is natural. I was born this way. And of course, it took me a long time to figure it out for myself and come to terms with it. But my queer journey, as opposed to my disability journey, is very different. So for me, you know, like queerness, it started day one, but I did not start to identify as queer until I was around 16 or 17. And then I was fully out to everyone by the time I was 19. So within 3 years, I took on, you know, this identity for myself, and I started to embrace it. And I was like, yes, I'm gay. Awesome. This is going to be a pivotal part of my persona. And I can only say good things. And so I, you know, came out of the closet, told family, I told friends. And the difference there was I immediately found a community. Cause I mean, I guess me and my friends in high school, we all weren't queer yet, but we gravitated towards each other anyway. And now post-college we've all come out, which is so funny. So I immediately, you know, I was doing theater, which is often a very queer environment. And so all of my friends were queer. So when I got to college and I was like, I'm pretty sure I'm gay. Like I all of a sudden had these older, you know, mentors who were like, awesome. So am I. Let's talk about it. Do you want to come to like this queer alliance, like group thing with me? Let's do this, this, and this. And it was just so positive because we have really been able to move queerness, especially in the younger generations, my generation and Gen Z, we're seeing queerness as being a lot more accepted. And yeah. So I was like, awesome. Great. Now, when it came to my disability journey, I was also disabled from day one, but I didn't accept that I was disabled until I was around 20 or 21. And that was because the lack of community, because I felt so, so alone. And it was a difference in how others would react to me saying I was disabled. Because I would, you know, tell someone who I'm meeting like, oh, hi, I'm Olivia, I'm gay. Like when we'd meet at a, you know, who knows what, it's one of the first things I say. And they'd be like, awesome, nice to meet you. While when I tell someone, hi, I'm Olivia, I'm disabled, they're like, oh, God.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, well, I love that you bring that kind of compare construct so that it is explainable, like how different it is.
It was. And I think with disability, it's just not as talked about, especially if you are growing up in an able-bodied family, like who is going to tell you about disability theory? What voices are you going to hear by disabled activists? Because often they are so silenced. They are really, you know, sequestered to one part of the internet. And so when it came to accepting my disability, while I started to do that, it was honestly more through accepting queerness that I was able to make this acceptance of my disability. And then, of course, you know, over the past 2 years, I found the Limpy community and I was like, woo, like great, other people like me. And I felt so much more comfortable saying it. But there is still that, even in the community, that weird viewing of disability where some are like, oh, is this the terminology we should use for this? I don't know. And so it's kind of convoluted. And complicated, but so it was interesting.
I was going to ask if you think your journey, like of coming out, did really help of accepting your disability, because it does sound like it.
Yeah, no, it absolutely did. And I was a women's gender and sexuality studies major in college. And so I was taking a lot of queer theory classes. And the thing with a lot of queer theory is there is an intersection with disability theory. The two build off of each other.
Interesting.
And so,
okay.
Yeah, while reading, like there's this one theory, it's coined by Robert McBrewer, which is compulsory able-bodiedness. And that is built off of Adrian Rich's theory of compulsory heteronormativity, which is the idea that everyone is straight and that is the normal. So McBrewer built the idea that everyone is able-bodied and that is the normal off of that queer theory. And so we see a lot of intersection. And so as I was learning more about queerness and feeling more comfortable and coming out into the community, I was like, oh, damn, we're seeing a lot of queer disabled authors too, talking about the intersection and this identity and how that has been beneficial for them. So I know for me, that was huge. Cause I, the way I learn is I just love to analyze myself and I love to like really
too.
Unpack everything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so I unpacked my queerness and that allowed me to then unpack my disability. And then all of a sudden I found disabled friends and, you know, we started having little group meetings and I found the Limpy community and here I am, but it was really, really necessary. And I do have to wonder though, if I were not queer, if I was straight, would I have been able able to find this disability acceptance. And I'm not sure of that. It would have taken a lot longer.
Well, I am an example of taking it a lot longer, right? Like I identify as straight. I think my ability to cope to more quote unquote normal scenarios pushed a lot more towards my later years, my ability to accept a lot of stuff. It was when my sexual organs started to be compromised with lymphedema, which I've talked about very openly.
Yeah,
I think that really was a moment of a turning point. That's the correct word to say, a turning point for acceptance as well. Because, you know, it, I think mine came from the angle of helping others and community.
Yeah.
Because if I had all this information and if I had gone through all this and then I was seeing people that did, then how is it? I'm not the only one. And then other people need to hear. And I said it to somebody recently as well. That sense of community changed me. Finding people that are like you and not feeling alone. And, you know, this is what this space tries to do as well. Not even if you don't need to find a community about what you have or what you're going through, but at least to know that whatever you're going through is normal. And anything in this world, it's a possibility and that you're not alone.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I mean, you know, it is, as you said at the beginning of this, like it's diversity. It's the diversity of the human condition. And it's one of the most beautiful things about existence is all of our differences and how we can still come together and make change and, you know, have an incredible impact on the world. And I'm like, it is so, so sad that so many, especially, you know, children feel so ashamed of these different part of themselves when at the end of the day, like what is more human than difference?
And absolutely.
It's something we need to embrace.
Amen.
So.
Amen. Olivia.
Preach.
Oh my God, Olivia. This has been amazing. It's everything I ever wanted for this
episode.
I'm so
excited. Yes.
And thank you for your honesty and being so wonderful. Look, I told you this once before, and I keep telling you, like, I admire a lot the way you speak about things and the way you can verbalize, because it took me a very long time. I still struggle because, I don't know, like, I'm more of a dreamer and like, an emotional being. So bringing those things to words sometimes are difficult, but you do it so flawlessly. So thank you. And thank you for educating us, because I think if anything we can bring, it's a bit of an education or like even like a light bulb moment in which you can think about things. I think we've made strides.
Absolutely.
So thank you for being wonderful. And thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. I was so excited when I got your message. I was like, yes, this is it. We're going to have such a blast. And here we are.
I told you a couple of months ago. It's coming. I just needed to find the window.
And here we are. So yes, thank you. This has been great. And I hope everyone, you know, learns a lot from it. But it goes to show when we all come together and we have conversations, we can make really incredible change. And we just have to be more open-minded, listen to each
other. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you, Olivia. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Bye.